Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs. Here are your hosts, Julie Fudge-Smith and Colleen Pilar.
Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs. I'm Colleen Pilar, and I'm here today with Julie Fudge-Smith. And today we're talking about the emotions people ascribe to dogs' behavior and how they're often negative, where we would say a dog is being stubborn or manipulative or resentful or willful. So, Julie, have you had experiences with that?
I have. I had one client in particular who had a German Shepherd, and they wanted the dog to go down the basement with them. And at first, and they were really upset because the dog would not go down the basement steps. And they were convinced it was because he was stubborn and he was willful, and she was sure that he resented the basement.
Did the dog go up other steps?
Yes, the dog would go up and down other steps just fine.
But not the basement.
But not the basement stairs. So okay. I was thinking, well, is it really all that important that the dog go down and do the laundry with you? And it turns out that it's not the laundry. They had their rec room in the basement. And they would go down there to watch movies. And she was sure that the dog resented the basement because they were down there watching movies and he was upstairs without them. And I found that in an unusual situation. So I finally said, can I see your basement stairs? She said, sure. So I walk over and I took one look at it and I knew immediately what was wrong. Because the dog would go up and down all the other stairs, but would not go up and down these stairs, the problem was these stairs were open in the back. And the dog found it terrifying. I've had dogs who will not go up and down open stairs.
Yes. Lots of dogs.
It is. It's a real common problem. If you think about it, it's very scary because that openness is right at their line of vision. As they're going up the stairs, they're staring off into an abyss, and they're not sure. It would be very scary to me to be walking up something and constantly looking out at a drop-off, which is what this boils
like
out
that,
to.
It's like those glass canyon bridge things that there now are all the tourist attraction places, and would you walk out onto the canyon bridge where it's all glass under your feet? No, thank you. And it's the same concept here with the dog, where they're just sort of looking through like I'm sort of walking on air. There's, it goes right through.
Yes.
Scary.
So what they had plans to finish off the steps. They just hadn't done it yet. So they did. They finished the steps, and it took some counter conditioning because the dog had been afraid of these steps for a long time. It wasn't immediately going, oh, you filled in the back of the steps. Hurrah, let's march up and down the stairs. So we had to use a lot of treats and convince him that it really was safe enough for him to go down. And when he did, he eventually became, you know, just fine going up and down the stairs. Well, they also, I was going to say too, they also changed the stairs by not only did they fill in the back, they put carpeting on it. So the stairs looked different. And that, I think, was also a help because the stairs no longer looked the same as the scary stairs that they had gone up and down before.
Carpeting typically gives dogs better traction too. So if you had ever been uncomfortable on the stairs, carpet feels safer under your feet than just a polished wood for a dog who has some fear. But isn't it interesting that fear is such a logical answer to this problem? Like, why was the dog not going up and down the stairs? Fear seems like such an obvious logical thought, and yet her thought was resentment of movie night. I think that sometimes we get ourselves set up in opposition with dogs, and one of the particular challenges I think we have is that we often hear dogs described as having a desire to please. And, you know, man's best friend and dogs have a desire to please. So what that says is a dog's one sole purpose in life is to make you happy. And I don't think anyone told dogs that.
No.
I think dogs have a desire to interact. You know, they're interested and they're social. But the desire to please is themselves. They're very interested in pleasing themselves. And if that pleases you too, then fantastic. But I don't think they're hardwired to make us happy. And when we have a dog and there's any sort of miscommunication or frustration, and everyone else's dog has this desire to please, but mine clearly is willful and defiant and stubborn because I'm not getting what I want. I'm not getting what I expected. That it creates, you know, relationship deterioration, partially because of our words and partially because of our attitude in how we're addressing some of these issues.
I agree. And I think that when people say to me, I always say, I want my dog to do it just because he loves me. And I'm like, well, okay. Or because he likes me or because he wants to please me. And I'm like, well, okay, let me ask you this. In your job, you probably want to please your boss. You want to make him happy, right? But you don't go to work just to please your boss. You go to work because you get something out of it too, usually a paycheck that pays the mortgage. So why do we really think that dogs are that selfless? There's got to be something in it for them. I think that's the way it works for pretty much everything with a couple of brain cells firing up there, that there's got to be something in it for them. And it could be that we train them that pleasing me is a great thing because you please me, then I tend to take you for more walks. So you end up getting something out of it. And that's not to say that they're manipulative. It's just that everybody does things because it does something for them, because there is a result in there that makes it worthwhile for me to do that. And
right.
And I don't think that that's necessarily, that's not a negative thing. That's just sort of the way of the world. And if we understand that, then I think it makes it much easier to be in conjunction with our dogs than in opposition with them.
Yes. And I think it's a mindset. And that when we look at it that way, that it all works out fine. It's not that the dog is doing anything to us or because of us. I was talking to a client recently who one of their dogs had died, and their other dog had started wetting in the house. And the explanation for this was that he was very, very angry with them whenever they would leave, because now they were leaving him alone, whereas previously they had left him with companionship. And stress is the far more logical answer to that. You know, it's not that he's angry. It's that he's stressed. Life has changed. But he's not thinking, look, I have the secret store of urine and I intend to use it to my
right. I'll show you.
I know. And dogs are all like, yay, urine, that's cool. So the idea of a dog using that as a bad thing is interesting too, because most dogs are just sort of like fascinated by the thought of that thing there. So when we talk about things that way and we look at things that way, it's a real challenging thing. So I think we always have to look first at what is the behavior, what's occurring, and are we being clear in our training? Are we setting this dog up for success? Have we created systems that help the dog succeed with the behavior that we want? So we have to be very intentional about all of this. I have a client currently who's really confusing in his training, and he means well, but he talks in full paragraphs to his dog and his body language is all over the place. So he's not giving any sort of clear signals to the dog. And then he's frustrated because he assures me he knows this. This dog knows this. And he's just being stubborn right now. And you know, I get frustrated by that. I understand his feelings, but he's so confusing that it's hard to say, by the way, you're confusing the heck out of your dog, because that's rude to a client.
Yes.
And yet we do have to broach that topic. We have to say, I don't think he's blowing you off. I think he doesn't understand.
No, correct.
Let's try to be more consistent.
Well, one of the things I try to tell people, and if I've got a one of these paragraph talkers, what I will tend to say is, I say, do you remember the old Charlie Brown cartoons where the teacher's in the background going, blah, mm-hmm. blah, 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 and they don't hear anything? I said, kind of similar to us for our dogs. The more we talk, the more we are like the Peanuts teacher or adult mm-hmm. talking in the background. And so if we use clear, concise ways to tell our dog what to do, we're more likely to get compliance, because they're going to hear that word, as opposed to if that word is hidden in that paragraph of verbiage, they're likely to miss it. And it's not that they don't want to, it's just they really, really can't, because they are just not at all sure what it is that you need to do. The other thing I try to do when I work with clients, I have a brand new one, has a lovely golden retriever, nice family, mom, dad, three kids, great dog. But they had been all over the place in training him. And the father said to me, would it be helpful if all of us were there for the first session? And I said, absolutely, because we're going to talk about philosophy of training and how to train, and we're all going to practice this together. And they did, and they were lovely, and they all tried hard. There were still some inconsistencies between them. And the dog, who had been dealt with so inconsistently, just kind of stood there and looked at us like, what's going on? You know, kind of looking back and forth, wagging his tail, obviously wanting to know what to do, but not sure what to do with this family. And the mother said, see, he's being stubborn. And I said, no, I think he's just starting to figure out what it is we want him to do, because I dealt with him quite consistently in the same way. I met him, gave him some treats, asked him to do some things, and he was very consistent and good for me, but he wasn't sure what they were trying to do because everything they had done before with him had been so inconsistent. So that's one of the things we're really working on with that family, is let's all handle the dog or work with the dog in exactly the same way so that he has a fighting chance of getting it right.
And learning a little bit about body language too, because when you're describing that dog to me, I see that dog as, you know, like the catcher standing there going, okay, what? I'm ready. As soon as I know what it is, I'm ready. But
are you throwing it high? You throwing it low? Is it a curveball? Yeah. What's going on here?
And since, you know, if the people are seeing that body language as not being receptive when just the way you describe it, you know, with the dog standing and looking and wagging and like, okay, you know, that's so receptive. Teaching people about body language and stress signals is really, really valuable. I mean, honestly, I think that is one of the very best benefits in new training that, for a long time, I don't think people taught body language at all.
No, I agree.
For the last 15 years, it is a huge topic that almost every dog trainer covers regularly, because if it wasn't covered, if you don't know what the dog is saying to you, it's not a communication. It's a one-way transmission. We need to hear it back and forth. Here's what I'm saying. Here's what you're saying.
I agree. In fact, I had a client had adopted a small dog. And she said, well, when they were out for a walk and he would cross back and forth and she would tell him, don't do that. And he would look back at her and then he'd cross right in front of her. So she's sure that he was manipulating them. And I said, okay, this is a 3-year-old dog, had pretty uncertain background, had been in a foster care for about a year with a lot of other dogs, hadn't been walked regularly, played with a lot of dogs and stuff. And I said, you know, honestly, I think what's going on here is the dog just doesn't know what the rules are. This is a training issue. This dog doesn't know what's expected of him. And the idea that we would just automatically expect our dogs to know that they are supposed to walk on one side by my leg is...
And not getting ahead of us. Because, you know, a lot of that is old school stuff too. You know, don't ever let a dog take one step ahead of you, because that's how they show how bossy and dominant they are. Oh, dear.
Yeah. And I was like, how in the world is the dog supposed to know this? You haven't even had him for 4 days. We haven't even started on loose lead walking. We're going to get there, but there's so many other things that we need to get in place before we get there. But one of the things I also did for her, because she was saying, well, he's stubborn about this and he's stubborn about that and he likes my husband better than me and he won't come when I call him. And I'm looking at this poor little guy and he's showing me all kinds of symptoms of fear. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things we did was we sat down and I went over in great detail with her stress signals. And as she began to understand what was going on with this little guy, you could just watch her soften.
Yeah.
It's like, wow, I didn't understand. I get it now. I can help him. I want to help him. And now I understand what he's telling me. I'm much more motivated to help him.
Right. It changes your role from being in opposition to the dog to being its advocate.
Absolutely.
How can I help this dog and set him up for success? As opposed to how do I tell him to stop doing what he's doing?
Absolutely. And one of the things we did talk about was the idea of advocacy, that you are your dog's best and only advocate. Mm-hmm. And you need to take that role on seriously. That doesn't mean that you have to go out with, you know, a flamethrower to keep everybody at bay, but it does mean that it is up to you to protect, just basically to protect and serve. You know, I'm there to protect you and to try and serve your best interests so that we can have this great life together.
Yeah. I do tell people that. I you know, the whole idea of getting a dog for protection. I'm like, no. Your job is to protect the dog.
Yeah.
You protect the dog. You're the one who's the human adult who understands what is dangerous and what is not in our culture. So you protect the dog. The dog does not protect you. And you have to really do a lot, which is not to say the dog won't ever step up in a moment of danger and protect somebody. But that can't be their role. We don't want them to be – we don't want family dogs – you know, deciding when do I have to protect someone else. We want family dogs knowing that they are protected and that they have someone advocating for them and understanding what works for them and what makes them uncomfortable.
But you can train them to bark. That's often mm-hmm. a big deterrent.
Training to bark is always a good thing for someone who's looking for that.
Right.
So back on the idea of, you know, them being stubborn and manipulative and some of our other negative emotions, one of the things I like to have people do when we get ourselves talking in this direction is I like to ask them to make me some top 10 lists. Mm-hmm. And those would be like, what are your dog's top 10 food rewards in order? So, like, does your dog prefer chicken nuggets to the cheese stick? How do you know? Have you tested? And to really decide, because dogs do have preferences, and many dogs like, oh, I like everything. Great. But what's your kryptonite? What's the one that is really, really right. powerful? And what are the top 10 activities? You know, how do you feel about belly rubs versus playing fetch versus going for a walk versus lying on the couch next to me? Those kinds of things, you know, knowing what your dog's things they value are, that gives you tools to play with when you're saying my dog is not doing what I want him to do. Well, these are things we can use to set things up in your favor. So as when the dog makes good choices and then he's rewarded with, oh, his favorite thing in the entire world, a tennis ball, that's really valuable. Or he's rewarded with something that's not terribly valuable, like thunk, thunk, thunk on the head. Well, that's not as likely to make the behavior occur next time. So if you really know what your dog loves, then that can be a very helpful thing in changing these stubborn dogs' behavior. Because I don't believe that there are dogs who are not food motivated, but there are certainly dogs who are less food motivated than other
yes,
dogs.
Yes. And I do the same kind of thing. I like the idea. You are a much stricter teacher than I, because I like the top 10 things of food and activities. I think I'm going to have to get stricter because I just ask for 5 things your dogs love. Give me a list of 5 things.
I only do it when we have a real problem. But, okay. Because I want you to actually stop and think, because probably you've only even tried 3 at that point. You
That's
know?
Right. That's right. And one time when we were out with all 3 dogs and it was the middle of winter and we were walking them in our nearby park, which led into a dog park, and they were off lead because nobody was out. And Bingley came running towards me, and he had something in his mouth, and it looked like a Frisbee. And I'm like, I didn't bring Frisbees. I brought tennis balls. What is it in your mouth, dude? And he comes running up, and he's all excited because he has half a frozen groundhog. Yay! Yay! It looked like somebody had flattened this thing out, cut it in half, and gave Bing the front end. And it was the little mouth is open, the little paws are there. And I'm like, I am not getting into a tug of war over a frozen groundhog. Simply not going to do that. But one thing I did know that Bingley loves above almost anything else in the world, tennis balls. And I had 3 of them. So I looked at him, I go, oh, Bingley, look what mommy's got. You know, I got this golden orb of control. And look what mommy's got. I got, do you want it? Do you want it? And as soon as he dropped the groundhog, that tennis ball left my hand within a half a second. He took off after it. I reached down, grabbed the groundhog, tossed it to my husband, who threw it in the woods, and then we ran up to meet him so that he didn't think about the groundhog.
You are good, good people, because I would have just run after my dog. I would have been like, yep, dead groundhog portion behind me, but I am not.
But it was the dead of winter. It was frozen. So if it had been spring, I would not have picked it up. But it was the kind of thing is that I instantaneously knew what he loved. He loved to play fetch, and he loved tennis balls. Pretty much, I think he'd sell me for a tennis ball or a cuz. And so it was nice. That's one of the things I always tell my owners is that you need to know what your dog loves, because it may actually save you from getting into an altercation with your dog over a frozen groundhog. And it might just save their lives if they drop something they're not supposed to have. And it will get you out of sticky situations in a way that is peaceful and fun and comfortable for everybody.
Right. Right.
And I don't think he was being stubborn. I think he thought it was pretty cool to have a half a frozen groundhog.
Yeah. But, and had he not dropped, if you told him to drop, you know, that wouldn't have been being stubborn either. That would have been going, wow, frozen groundhog. That
versus
would be
a milk bone? I'm not giving up the groundhog for a milk bone, Mom. It's right. Got to be something worthwhile for me to give it up.
Yes. So that requires a level of training, and we can't expect dogs to, you know, respond consistently a high level of training if we haven't put in the time and effort and consistency to have that high level of training. So that's a real important piece of this is when we're looking at it, are we training? Are we actually teaching what we think the dog should know? And are we teaching it to the level of fluency that we would really like this dog to have? And I am totally fine with dogs not having razor sharp skills for their family behaviors, as long as they're pretty good in almost all situations. But you have to recognize that we're not going to have perfect behavior then if you haven't trained perfect behavior. Because guess what? Nobody's perfect. But most of us are kind of average. And average is okay, but you have to know that what you've got is average.
Right, but that's where that super valuable reward, going back to your list of favorite foods and favorite activities, comes in. Because maybe if your dog has brought you a stick, you'll trade it for a milk bone. But if he's bringing you a half a frozen groundhog, you had better be thinking clearly about what it is your dog loves. Because even if he's not trained as well, if you present him with manna from heaven, reward for me is well worth giving up whatever it is that I had. So rewards are incredibly important in supercharging your training and for getting you out of sticky situations. So knowing what your dog loves can help you to overcome that average training.
So I guess sort of to recap here, I think first off, we should be really conscious of the words we use. So are dogs stealing socks or are they picking socks up? Are dogs, you know, being resentful, manipulative, stubborn, and angry? You know, be really aware of when we're using words that describe motivation as opposed to the actual behavior.
And they're inflammatory.
Yeah, they are inflammatory. And then when we use these words, that's a lovely red flag for us to say, okay, that's a moment where I have to stop and think. What am I getting that isn't what I want? So how can I train more consistently and use the motivators that I know how to use more effectively to create the behavior I want? And also, environmental management is huge. You can't always control the half a frozen groundhog situation, but for a lot of the situations in our houses, we can control the environment so that the behavior we don't like isn't repeating over and over. Right. So if we're looking at that, and then really also recognizing, am I meeting my dog's needs? You know, is the dog getting enough downtime, enough exercise, enough fun games, enough mental stimulation? So some of these, you know, he barks all day and I yell at him and he just won't shut up. Well, that's, he's not being stubborn. He's being aroused and frustrated and probably needs some more outlets. So
and you getting aroused and frustrated with him may be exacerbating the situation.
Indeed.
Because you're just mirroring the same behavior. The other thing is, I would add into this as sort of a bit of a recap, is sometimes dogs get confused because people use a combination of both rewards and punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So the dog doesn't know what he's supposed to do because he doesn't know, if I do this behavior, does that mean I get a cookie or I get a choke?
Yeah.
And so dogs, I think, sometimes appear to be stubborn when they're very confused and maybe even fearful, because I don't know what the consequences of my actions are going to be because you are so inconsistent. I don't know if you're going to hurt me or love me. And I think that causes a lot of confusion and quote-unquote stubbornness in dogs because they're frozen. I don't know what to do because I don't know what's going to happen if I do something.
Yeah, and that's a terrible thing. I mean, what we really want to do is use positive training so that dogs are willing to act, you know, like take, I think this is what you want. Is that what you want? And then you go, nope, that's not what I wanted. Let's try it differently. As opposed to the dog that's standing there going, I am not sure what you want. And I'm really afraid to make that guess because it could go very, very wrong. We never want that.
No, we never want that. It's important to remember once again that stress signals are a great way in which you can begin to piece apart what your dog is actually telling you. Maybe it's not resentfulness, maybe it's fear. So I think knowing stress signals, being consistent and clear in the way in which you train your dog, and knowing that everybody's going to make mistakes, hopefully not fatal ones, but you know, you know, people are going to make mistakes and dogs are going to make mistakes. So having a good reward will also help you to overcome some of those mistakes that your dog may make.
Be aware, if you're saying things like he's being stubborn or he's stealing things, those are the words you're using. That doesn't actually describe the real behavior.
That's right. And going back also to be careful of the verbiage, your dog only doesn't need a paragraph. He needs a word. All right. I think that's great, Colleen. I think that one of the things we want to remind our listeners is that we do like phone calls. We do like questions. And we do like comments. So we would love to hear from you. And you can contact us at our website, which is www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com. Or, Colleen, can you give them the phone number, please?
Sure. 614-349-1661.
All right. And we hope that you enjoy having dogs in your life as much as we do. And we'll see you next week.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Colleen and Julie would love to hear them. Call 614-349-1661 or visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.
If you enjoy our show, please tell a friend about it. We'd love to reach people who feel as we do, that life is better with a dog.